This is Business of Home. I'm your host, Dennis Scully. Every week, I'll be talking to leaders and innovators from all corners of the home industry. My guest this week is Ben Sulmani, a longtime rug dealer and the founder of the home furnishings brand that bears his name. Ben's story is a dramatic one. The son of a prosperous rug dealer in Iran, his family escaped the country in the thick of the revolution. Ben eventually found himself in Los Angeles and wasted no time getting into business. First as a teenager, establishing his family's operations in California, then branching into contemporary design and partnering with Gary Friedman to establish RH's rug program. Now Ben has a whole home brand of his own, selling everything from the rugs he's famous for to textiles, furniture, and accessories. We talked about how the design industry's attitude towards rugs has evolved over the years, why he thinks in-stock, quick-ship product is the wave of the future, and why he loves taking on a challenge. This podcast was sponsored by Serena and Lily. With a dedicated trade team and design shops from coast to coast, Serena and Lily's exclusive trade program has the personalized service, products, and custom details you need to execute your vision seamlessly. From trade-only discounts to complimentary swatches, COM to custom by the inch, being a Serena and Lily trade member offers endless inspiration, giving you and your clients the unique look you deserve. Join their trade program by visiting serenaandlily.com/trade. In 2006, a fashion designer from New York City and a furniture designer and builder from Tucson, Arizona, fell in love. The result was this week's sponsor, Baker Heseldon's studio. The husband and wife team's work is boundlessly unique and full of endearing contradictions. They create heirloom quality pieces that are inspired by everything from the rooftop spires in Istanbul to the pedestal rock formations of the American Southwest. If your interest has been piqued, find out more on Instagram. Their handle is @BakerHeseldens. And in case you're wondering, it's spelled H-E-S-S-E-L-D-E-N-Z. And now, on with the show. Ben, thanks so much for joining us today. You've got this whole home brand that you're building right now, and we're going to get to that. But first, I wanted listeners to hear some of your early life story. Before your new company, before working with RH, and before Mansour Modern, as a young child, you grew up in Iran at a very pivotal time, right before the revolution and right before the fall of the Shah. How did you ultimately leave?
We left Iran in two tranches.
Okay.
My father, mother, my siblings, brother, sister, we came to the U.S. on vacation in the summer of 1978. Mid-1978, I would have been 6 years old. In that August, they burned a big cinema in Iran, in one of the other cities, not the capital. And that's where really the violence and the uprooting, the revolution started. Now, of course, my father, you know, he was a wise man. So when we were in the U.S. and this started to happen, at that time, he left my brother and sister here. My mother, my father, and I, since I was six, you know, we went back. We went back, and all as a kid I would hear is, you know, machine gun, ta-ta-ta-ta-ta at night, and people in the streets and screaming. And a lot of the machine guns, we found out later, wasn't even true. It was just tapes that they used to play to scare people.
It really to sort of make everyone anxious and nervous.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can't tell you as a kid that did a number on me.
Of course.
I mean, so, you know, it was a bit, you can't just overnight leave everything and go. He couldn't get out everything, but, you know, he got out what he could. He's got out most of his inventory.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. So remind me what your father's business was. Obviously, it was this rug business, but help me understand what that looked like and the scale of it at the time.
We are fourth generation into the rug business, but he came to Tehran at the age of 12, 13, I believe, which was the capital. And that's where he really started his efforts and grew. And by the age of 16, opened up his own rug shop on one of the best streets in Iran. So it's a very fascinating story, and I'm very proud of him. He worked unrelentlessly to get to where he had to. By the age of 25, he was dealing with the presidents and prime ministers and queens and kings coming to Iran. He obviously, at that time, he only dealt with Persian carpets. And what was popular then was not less the antique so much, but more the really finely woven silk rugs that are very intricate and take years to make. So I'm very proud of him, really. The things that this man did in his life are extraordinary, and I will never forget. And this has really been the light under me, the drive, the passion. In 1978, when I went back with my mother, they thought that it would be best that I go also with my mother back to the U.S. as my father was trying to get out. So we came back to the U.S., to Los Angeles, actually, and we stayed here another, I'd say, 3-4 months, and then my mother and I actually went back to Iran again.
Oh.
This is now during the revolution. During the revolution. The Shah had already left. Khomeini was there. And we went back and we spent another 2 months there, and with my father, we left. So it was a back and forth before we left. We lived between London and Los Angeles for a few years and then permanently moved to London because my father found that his business relationships, the Arabs, the people who were his customers, the dignitaries, were much easier to reach in London as they all came there all the time.
So did he struggle to get a lot of inventory out of Iran? I mean, that was a pretty crazy time once the revolution had really started and Khomeini came into power.
So he did it before that.
I see. So he had started moving things out.
Right. So in 1978, when we went back and the burning started, that's when I remember even he had a partner and he would say, my partner doesn't want to send anything out. So, and I tell my partner, we'll send everything out. Mm. If everything's okay, we'll bring it back. Mm. And that's what my father did.
Okay.
But we were lucky in that way. Yes. I mean, we lost a lot of things, you know, homes and land and type of stuff we lost.
And you had to sort of walk away from all of that.
Walk away. A lot of people walked away from a lot of things.
I see.
When I graduated from high school, which was in 1988, I was 16. And London is always in my heart. I mean, I'm a British citizen. It will always be a place that taught me a lot. So at the age of 16, I was really ready to leave home, be on my own feet, of course, with the help of my family, my mother and father, which guided me and helped me in every way to get me started in the beginning. Business was in LA. And for me, everything was, I want to get into business. I was 16 and just dying to get into business.
So everything, get into a business, or were you thinking you would always be in the rug business? I mean, was it the
obviously
family
in the rug? Obviously in the rug business.
Okay.
Because
okay.
Look, I mean,
ever wanted to sort of pull away and go do something else.
It's what I had learned. It's what they put into my blood. It's what I learned every single day. I mean, my father, you know, he would come home with a different rug every day that he would buy in the market that he collected. And as he would open the door, I was 7, 8. I would tell him exactly where that rug was from.
You would know right away.
I'd know right away. But it's by the back, by the edge, by the color of the binding, by the...
So help me understand that, Ben. What are the telltale signs that you look for? Because this is one of the things I want to talk to you about today, is helping us to understand better what to look for in these fine rugs that your family became so famous for bringing forward.
Rugs traditionally in Persia are made in different cities, different regions. Some regions are tribal, some regions are city. Then the colors that were used in different regions will tell you where it's from. So, you know, certain regions use certain combinations. There were colorful regions, they were subdued. 9 out of 10 were colorful. Design was also big. I mean, I remember, you know, while kids are 6, 7 years old drawing cars or whatever, airplanes or whatever, I would be drawing rug designs sitting in class. And that's what I did. You know, by the age of 7, 8, I really knew as much as any rug expert would know as where things are from, when they were made. Also, you know, different cities, different regions through time did different things.
So Ben, take me back to when you were eager to get into the business and what sort of your early steps were to get involved in the business originally.
So as I said, I came here, I went to, you know, the dorms lasted 3 months. I used to then drive from LA an hour a day to school, an hour back, so I could work in the afternoons in LA. And then pretty soon after the first year was over, what I did is I decided, look, I am not concerned about a degree. I am more concerned about learning the things that I need. So I stopped taking courses that are physics or things that I didn't think I'd need to use in my life, and took every business course there was here locally in Los Angeles at night. And I started to work during the day. And at that point, my father was so kind enough to believe in me, trust in me at the age of 16, 17, and buy a piece of land on Melrose for the first development I did on Melrose. And I built that building.
So you told your father that you wanted to buy real estate on Melrose. And
well, my father also had the vision of bringing the business now that I'd moved to America, believing and trusting me and let me start that business in America. So and the first thing to do is we didn't want to go into the big blue whale. We wanted to do something.
The Pacific Design Center, the big blue whale.
The Pacific Design Center.
Right.
It's known as the big blue whale.
Yes. I know. Affectionately. Yeah. The big blue whale. Yes. So you didn't want to go in there. So you thought at the time you wanted to be on the street, and Melrose seemed like the place.
Right. And my father, and it was a different world. It was a less onerous world, let's say.
Okay.
In the early 90s.
So that's when this was, in the early 90s. And why not go in the Pacific Design Center? Why not go in the building that was already attracting all the designers? And I mean, what was the thinking at the time?
We wanted to build our own beautiful, a gem of a building that showed the big windows and the tall ceilings. We had, like, in that whole 15,000 square foot building that I built back then, we have two columns. You know, I mean, we built the whole building. And then back then, also, security was a problem. They used to go and make holes in, you know, the stuccoed walls and take rugs out the hole. And it used to be a lot of that. So we built a building that was all concrete. Nobody could get in. It was safe. It had the high ceilings. It had the volume. And it had, you know, it represented who we were, what my father had achieved to that date. It really represented us well. The biggest thing I learned in my life is never let somebody be ahead of you with the money.
What does that mean?
It means if somebody had a contract for X dollars and they're only 20% done, never make sure they have more than 15%. If they had 25%, maybe they wouldn't show up tomorrow. Mm. And we finished the building in 93. Mm-hmm. I remember I opened the doors in August 93. You know, it was such an exciting time. It was such an exciting time. Then, you know, of course, my father made an initial investment. After that, I started to run a business. I started to learn how do you balance your account. You have these expenses. You have to pay them. How to worry about getting the checks paid. We just started.
Yeah.
From scratch. In America, they knew us from London, but we started from scratch. But I tell you, within a couple of years, I got to know every top designer in Los Angeles on a personal basis. Every day I would work, you know, I'd go to the office at 7, I'd finish at 6, and at night I would visit clients or I'd have dinner with a designer. And 6 days a week, Saturdays we were open, and Sundays I would sometimes go to New York on night trips, take a red eye Saturday night to New York. They used to collect antique rugs for me to go look at and buy.
Oh, so pickers would work in New York to show,
exactly.
Get ready to show.
That's where all the antique rugs were.
I see.
In the East Coast.
Right.
That's where the money was back when these things were shipped to the U.S. I would go every 4 weeks, I'd say. That was my Sunday. I'd arrive back Sunday night dead.
I can imagine. Exhausted.
The only way I could do it is my age, I guess.
That's probably what aged you the most, right?
But the age and the power that you have at that age when you're young,
I know,
and if you believe in something, it's incredible what you can do.
Yeah.
But they really, who I am today, my eye and my understanding started with my father, who gave me all of that till that certain age. But beyond there, the perfection of my eye, the perfection of my aesthetic, the perfection of my what I love has to do a lot with these amazing designers that I work with in New York, in Chicago, in LA, in San Francisco, many great designers and old friends. Like, I don't know if we're supposed to name people.
Yes, please. Who were some of your early, I mean, I would love to know. I mean, of course.
I mean, like a Paul Wiseman has been a great mentor.
Oh my goodness. Yes.
An amazing friend. I met him when I was a young kid.
Right.
You know, Victoria Hagen. I remember meeting her at the client came to me first, and then through the client I met Victoria, and I was maybe 22 years old standing in a very famous townhouse, which which we can stay away from.
Well, so I'm curious, when you were starting this business in the 90s, what was the competitive landscape like? So where were people buying rugs at that time, and who were you sort of coming in and sort of disrupting a little bit?
Rugs was in a funny situation then, because before that, it was all going out of business, you know, 80% off, and a lot of that was going on at that time. But there were two or three good dealers in each city, especially in the bigger cities. At least in New York and LA, there were two or three established dealers that were dealing in better antique, and they used to call them decorative rugs back then. But rugs as a whole was not nearly part of design as it is today. It was more an afterthought that you did the house and then you found the rug, that's it. It was not like, let's go make a rug, let's go get the exact color we want. Right. Rugs back then were all blue and red for the most part.
Huh.
And it was more as an art piece perhaps that you put after the fact. But it was not a part of design. People did not start the job by picking the rug first. Which
today I feel like so many designers, that's it's all about starting with the rug, right?
100%. Yeah. All the real top designers, that's what they do.
Yeah.
They find a rug that the client loves, that has the palette, and then they build on it. So it's really the base for the room. Mm. Rug is such an important part of the room.
Yeah.
One of my achievements in my life that I am proud of is really getting that bridge of bringing the rug world into the design world. And part of that was maybe being younger and being more of a visionary of understanding what design is today at that time, right? And trying to bring rugs to that by doing new colors of today and what people want today. And me designing and making rugs that people want today. Part of it was that. And part of it was also education. You know, people didn't know, why should a rug cost so much? Why should an antique rug be this? Or what?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think that's one of the most challenging things for people about buying rugs is the lack of education and understanding what does make the difference in price.
Exactly. So I spent many, many years concentrating on how can I make this an easier thing, a fun thing, not something that, oh, now I have to go find the rug. More design centric, I'd say. And, you know, it took to about the early 2000s for rugs to become part of design.
So what did you do? How did you explain? How did you sort of help people to understand better? And I'm assuming that gave you a tremendous opportunity to sort of be the authority on this if they saw you were really knowledgeable. So tell me about that.
I tell you, it's really about listening. You know, a lot of the dealers that were in this business were older, set in their ways. I mean, if you told them, let's go design a carpet, they tell you you're crazy. Hmm. That's not how it works. So a lot of it is listening to what these designers wanted, listening to what in an ideal world they would do to decorate the way they want to. How do you make rugs just like fabrics or other things part of the design early on, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of, it got to a point, as you said, the rug sets the example of what a room should end up looking like. Right?
Yes.
So that's what we did. I mean, I listened. I listened to what they wanted and I went out there and tried to deliver it. Or even with the antique rugs. I mean, you know, I didn't argue with somebody that this is okay. I listened to them and they said, this rug, these colors are too harsh or this has too much contrast. I got it. So I was always trying to get them what they want. I listened. And that's why, you know, by the late 90s, I would get packages from every single top designer in this country when they had the jobs where they could use real good antique rugs with fabrics, ideas. They weren't, you know, at that point, they wouldn't pick the fabrics. They'd want to pick the rug, they would send you enough, a floor plan and enough things to show you what they see as the perfect look. And I was picking the rugs for them, giving them one or two options per room. And it was amazing. You know, we would do a whole home just like that. And I would ship the rugs and they do the installations and see them in the place and keep what worked. So I think part of it was just getting design, whereas most people in the rug business back then did not really understand design.
Was the rug business at the time catering to interior designers, and were they offering interior designers the kind of discounts or the kind of pricing that designers often need to be able to sort of resell things to their clients? Was it really set up that way, or is that something that you also sort of came along and kind of built into your model? Help me understand that.
It really wasn't.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it wasn't.
Okay.
It was more catered to affluent people who could afford them versus designers. As I said, it wasn't a part. Most of the time, the designers would even do the house and the rug that people would buy themselves, whatever they liked.
It was an afterthought, like you said.
Yes. Yeah. I can't tell you the amount of times that designers would do a home and suddenly their client went to Turkey on a trip and they'd buy some rug that had nothing to do with their vision. It wasn't until it became easier for the designers to pick what they wanted, to have that available to them, that it became part of the trade world. And really, I provided that for them. So all the top designers felt very comfortable. And it was really the go-to.
And did you figure out a model for pricing for them? Or how did you answer that challenge of the design?
We absolutely kept the 25%, I think back then it was. 25% discount.
You had a trade discount. Absolutely. 25%. Okay.
Absolutely. And really, at my family business, most of my business ended up being with designers. Hmm. By the 2000s, it was 80% designers. Hmm. So whatever I did, I saw the fruits. You know, I gave the designers who I've always taken my cue from the designers. Today, I take my cue from designers. Because this business, if you can satisfy the trade world, you'll satisfy the rest. You have to, the standard to sort of gauge oneself is what designers approve of or like. So that's what we did. And we made it, I made it much more of a design-centric business. Designers, I mean, in, out. It got to a point where designers were just passing by. They come in and have a cup of tea with me. Really?
Well, how great. I mean, and honestly, isn't that the key to success in this industry?
Of course. 100%.
Yes.
And 100%.
Yes. And this is the lesson that people so often, it eludes them for some reason. This That's is what it's all about. It's relationships. Yes?
Of course. 100%. I mean, designers are the nicest people in the world. They are.
Exactly.
They are people who are art-centric people. What makes them tick is design. What makes them tick is this artistry. Normally in the world, money and financial and design are two separate things, nothing to do with each other. Mm. The person who's very art and sort of very creative is normally not a very good business person. Thank God, coming from a father who was a very good businessman, I learned my business part well. But I was always very interested in the design part. From a young kid, designing, drawing, designing, color, combinations of colors, what colors look good together, not too busy, not too good. Less is more. You know that less is more.
Less is more.
I have followed that in design from day one of my life. And you know what? All the top designers that I knew and I worked with and I know were the same. I mean, yes, in the 90s, I mean, there was a little bit of the over-the-top French.
Yes.
This and that.
Yes.
There was a little bit of that.
Yes.
But for the most part, it was always less.
So tell me what Mansour Modern was. So then you sort of took another big step there, yes?
I mean, so I was doing these, you know, I was making the rugs back then, obviously, already. This is in 2005 or 6, I believe, we came officially out with the name Mansour Modern. Mm. But I was making these things, and it got to a point where, you know, there was so much inventory and things that I was doing that could be separated. And at that time when I started doing contemporary, you know, I'd say late 1998, 99, 2000, 2003, but definitely a lot before everybody else was doing contemporary. I mean, in the rug world, they even thought I was crazy at some point.
Because you were making so much, or?
No, because I was doing contemporary.
Ah, okay. They thought this will never last. This is a
right. So I was ahead of the game, I'd say. But it was something that has been going on for the last 20 years. Being ahead of it was really very helpful for me, and it was a hit. It was a great hit, and it was really one of the first companies to come out with a real modern, contemporary, clean, less is more line. Mm. We worked with some designers. I mean, Victoria Hagen designed, Michael Smith designed, Carrie Joyce designed for the company. A lot of fun working with them. I took Carrie to around the world with me. I remember Istanbul and to Nepal. He didn't like Nepal as much. It wasn't as clean as Istanbul. You know, it's a third world country.
Yes.
Very challenged back.
Yes.
But, you know, thank God they have all gotten a lot cleaner, more sanitary, more safe, better. Right. So that is one thing that, and you know what? When I got into the production game, another thing is I got a lot of people employed. Mm. You know, a lot of people were involved in the work.
Yeah.
Which is also very pleasing. You go to these countries and it was very nice to see people, you know, living on campus, making rugs, their kids going to school on the same campus. You were really helping people. I mean, let's put it this way. Whoever made rugs didn't starve.
Right.
Whereas there was a lot of people starving in these countries when we were doing the work.
No, to be sure. So then we get to about 2010, and I understand this fellow named Gary Friedman comes into your life. Yes? How did that happen? How did that come about?
So it was, you know, he was really starting to try to get the company into a higher end focus at that time. And we didn't meet for rugs or, I mean, his wife at the time, Kendall Agins, had bought antique rugs, I guess, for their home. I didn't know Gary back then at all. So there was some, and also, you know, I mean, before I met him, obviously, I started to hear more about Restoration Hardware and Gary Friedman, and he'd heard about me through different friends, and he knew that the Melrose real estate, part of what I did was I wanted to get the street after we did the first.
You started to buy some other locations.
To buy other locations, to see who are the other tenants on the street, right. Upgrade the street.
Right.
You know, there's nothing like amazing co-tenancy to build up the street. So he wanted to come to Melrose. He wanted to open a showroom on Melrose. They did some really beautiful showrooms around the country. And this was one of the first real flagship. And Gary's a genius and had an amazing idea. I mean, he really had an idea, which I have to give it to him. He comes up with ideas in his head and he sticks to it. And with hard work and perseverance, he's made a lot happen. So we have to give him that. Say, you know, he's done a great job of building that company from where it was and where it is today.
Absolutely.
So we met. He came. You know, we met over coffee because he wanted to open up Melrose. So you know, I had just bought finished completing a block. So I had properties here there, but some of them completed a block, some didn't. So this one, I had just finished completed a block, and we said this would be the perfect location, and we started talking, and we planned it, and of course we had to go through the city and the whole rigmarole of getting it all approved, but we did it. And that deal was done on a handshake, and the first deal. And the way things happened were, you know, we became friends. It was a nice, really gentleman sort of respect creating a deal that was good for him. It was good for me.
So initially the deal was about him being able to build on your property.
We built a showroom. Yes, we built a showroom on one of our on property on a land that I had just finished completing. And it was the perfect scenario. And then when it got closer, and he tapped into me for the rugs, and I almost was like, "You definitely, the rugs are not where you want to go."
So you tried to talk him out of it.
No, the rugs where they were at that day.
Ah, okay.
What they were doing was not where they were trying to go with the quality, the design.
He had a bigger vision of where he wanted it to go. Right.
Yeah. And it was a very small business for them.
Yes.
So, you know, it was a challenge because it's in numbers now, you know. I mean, whatever I did in the family business was 5s, 10s, 15s, 20s, right? A normal order of something. Whereas when I came with Restoration Hardware, everything was bigger, obviously, was with bigger numbers, was with bigger. And really it was a challenge to, within a budget, to create good rugs.
Jun Ho loved the Baker Heseldan studio aesthetic so much that he picked it to accompany his own work at his New York and Chicago trade showrooms.
In 2021, Baker Heseldent's studio will be debuting a slew of new pieces, including a cast bronze indoor-outdoor collection designed in collaboration with Scott Pask, the 3-time Tony Award-winning set designer of The Book of Mormon. The duo is constantly working on new and exciting projects, so stay informed by checking their website or by following Baker Heseldent's on Instagram. That's H-E-S-S-E-L-D-E-N-Z. And now, on with the show. So you were saying your family business, you were dealing sort of in smaller quantities? And
of course. I mean, it was a smaller base. So we were dealing with smaller numbers. Mm-hmm. But the challenge, the thing, see, for me in life, I mean, I like things that are not easy, just sitting in front of you that you can tap into, that you got to go build it. And then the satisfaction of that is next to none. I mean, that's what makes me thrive. At that time, this was a great challenge. And, you know, what I did for them, I think was extraordinary. I mean, I multiplied their business by big numbers. We achieved a lot together, and it was good for them and it was good for me. And I learned a lot and they learned a lot.
What did you learn during that time? What did you, I mean, as you say, you were scaling a business in a very different way than you had done before. Yes. You were really.
Absolutely.
And finding a price point that could work for that kind of customer that was coming to RH, right?
Absolutely. So I took on this business as it's my own. I really not just made rugs for them. I strategized the business, tried to see who the customer is, do the right weaves, do the right techniques, do the right price points, do the right, where we could achieve the higher volume numbers and consistency. Built a huge team in India that was controlling everything. And I still have the same exact team. I haven't fired one person.
Is that right?
Absolutely. I have the same team that I did when I had the restoration business. I've kept everybody, because once you find good people in these countries, you know, and you have relationships, you keep them.
So you built sort of a huge operation in
absolutely.
India to make
absolutely.
This possible. And you identified the weaves that you could deliver consistently
absolutely.
at a price point that would work. Right. Okay. So that was a lot of what you learned during that time.
Consistency. How do you get more consistency? How do you get more control? I'll give you an example. People would go and order and make things and never get involved in the yarn, never get involved in the... No, I would buy the yarn. I'd make sure the yarn quality is what it has to be. Mm-hmm. And they would weave the rug. So I took control of every possible part that I could take control into my own hands to control that everything was steady and the quality was stayed where it needed to, even at big numbers. So that's what I learned how to do. And it's not easy. That is not an easy thing to do. It takes a lot of traveling. I remember in the first couple of years, I went to India like 15 times in a period of 2 years. Hmm. I was running out of stamps. I was traveling so much. Running out of pages for stamps in my passport.
In your passport, yeah.
In my passport. Yeah. But that's what we did. And it was a great experience. And, you know, every partnership has a beginning and an end. And for me, I saw, you know, companies have different plans. You know, in 2010, what Gary wanted to do with the company versus 2018 when I left, are two different things. So I saw that, you know, for me, it's now I was also another thing happened. In 2017, God gave me twins.
Ah, yes. The little ones come into your life.
So yeah, I got married in 16. I got married late because in my life, I was just working.
You were too busy.
I was honest to God too busy. Yeah, marriage is just like anything else, and more than anything else. You need to put into it. It's the rest of your life. You need to make sure it's correct. Yes. It's the right thing. And if you're not really focused on it, you shouldn't do it, in my opinion. So I didn't do it. I waited till I was at the right time. And it's also, of course, meeting the right person. Thank God I've been very lucky. Mm. My beautiful wife is the biggest support to me. And God gave us the kids. And now, as soon as you have kids, it's not your life anymore. Whatever you do during the day is doing it for their future. Remember, my father brought me up the same way. Mm-hmm. He did everything for us. He believed in us. He brought me at a young age. He supported me. I didn't have the financial backing at the age of 17, 16, 17 when I left London. He was there for me. He trusted me. And he made it about what's the future is his children. So for me, that's the natural way of thinking. As soon as I had the children, well, what is the next 10 years going to look like? What is the next 20 years going to look like? And I wanted to start my own company, this time with no partner, no family, no partners, no outside company. And I didn't want to do rugs, because today when you make a company and when you have a website and when you have a client, that client is worth a lot. And if we were just doing rugs, it's every few years people need rugs. I wanted to create a company that is all design. And in the middle of all of these years, I built 6 different homes. And even though I use designers, Waldo is a great friend of mine that's worked on most of the houses I did. Carrie Joyce did a house for me. The process of doing this work with them also taught me a lot about the whole process.
I'm sure.
And I was really hands-on, as you can imagine, because design is important to me and I care about where I live. I mean, I have an aesthetic of my own that I really care about. So I really got involved in that process too. So, and I had made a lot of furniture by that time for myself. I had made a lot of custom things beyond just rugs, for my own homes. So I decided to use all the knowledge and all the history and all the experience and do a home company, which we did. I left RH at the end of 2018. We launched our website, the first website, the new business, Ben Soleimani, February, March 19, we launched. It was really fast.
It was very fast. And it makes me wonder, you know, you mentioned earlier that over the years, sort of Gary's thinking had changed a little bit. It sounds like your thinking had started to change a little bit. You were perhaps thinking well before that you might want to make this big change. Yes. And as you say, I mean, the children came along and you got married and lots of things changed. So a lot of things were pointing you in a different direction.
And absolutely.
And right. It's not like you thought about it. And then 5 minutes later, there it was.
No. I think the first time that I really thought about it was the beginning of 18. Hmm. I had to either renew my contract with them for another 5 years or not. And that was the back and forth. And in the middle of that, the light bulb went on. Partnerships, you know, they have a start and an end. I mean, that I knew.
Sure.
Even 10 years before, I knew. It was just the right moment. It was the right time. Yeah. And so, you know, I started to plan, I would say, towards the end of 18. And we were up for business in February or March of 19. At that time, I remember when I was meeting the press and I said, we're doing a home line and furniture is going to come. And when is it coming? And within 6 months. And people would look at me like, this guy's crazy. What's he talking about? You don't go build a home business in 6 months. Just being who I am, again, the pages started to get all filled out real fast in my passport because of all the traveling.
Did you know... when you left RH, did you know you were going to put your own name on the door and that was going to be the business? Was it always in your mind that it was going to be Ben Soleimani?
I think so. You know, after the name also for 30 years, it's been out there. You know, people know, people associate it with we deliver. I mean, I've always delivered. If we say something, we deliver. That's a big problem in the design world today.
And was that part of what you thought your name represented? That you deliver
quality, obviously quality. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a limit of where you quality or not quality, and you don't go below that. So, top quality, highest end of the market, dealing with all the top designers. That's who my audience is. So, I coming back to my audience more so. Of course, some of the designers stayed in touch and continued buying my things through Restoration Hardware and. And also, when I left, when I went to Restoration Hardware, after 2 years, I left the family business. So I sold my share out to my brother, and he has been running the company since. I want to clarify that. I have nothing to do with Mansoor anymore, rather than just seeing him do well and wishing him the best.
Well, and I remember that. And what made you get to that point too? What made you want? I mean, I know you say family businesses are complicated, and believe me, I know. I have a family business too, and I'm not a part of it for that reason. But what was it for you? What made you know it was time to step away from your family operation altogether?
The limit of growth, because the other family members were not so much for growth.
Okay. They didn't want to go where you wanted to go. They didn't want to make it.
I think one store and staying, you know, I think was sort of what the other family members wanted, more so my brother. And sort of for me, it was, you know, an opportunity to go and work and learn and continue growing. Really, really. That's what it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, even with the Mansoor Modern thing, you know, at some point I wanted to make a lot of them in different cities, not the antique, but that was a problem. And, you know, it's like, so then this opportunity of, you know, so much growth could possibly be in learning and growth as a human being to achieve, to go back on traveling again and getting things done and seeing the fruits. And that's the thriving of that for me is the utmost. And, you know, at that point, it wasn't like, you know, I built what I had really pretty much built or helped to build, you know, here in the U.S. wasn't just going to, you know, it's not like I was selling it to strangers, my family, and they were continuing. So, you know, it's okay. It was fine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And believe me, I stayed in touch and helped him in every possible way when I left, every possible way for him to keep flying. So that was important to me.
Yes.
I'm glad I did that.
Yes.
And so that break happened. And, you know, so I think people knowing the name, the understanding, and it was really, it's a way of me coming out saying, here, it's my name. It's my stamp. This is the quality. This is what you expect. You've known me for 30 years. This is what you're going to get. I am always answering to the designer. I'm not answering to the homeowner, because the homeowner, if you answer to a professional at something, then you're good for the rest, right?
Right.
So it was a chance that it was the right opportunity to use the name, I believe. And we debated it in the beginning, you know, but I think at the end everybody's advice was stay to your name. Everybody knows you with your name.
Well, and you had become so well known, and I mean,
thank you.
Bless RH's heart. They did a lot of advertising with your picture in it for many years. So,
that was good for you.
That was a good thing for you.
But I think in the designer world, I was just as well known before.
Yes. Yes. With all the groundwork that you had laid early on when you were starting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Known for their unique coastal-inspired mix, Serena and Lily makes good design their business, working with trade professionals like you to transform interiors. Join their trade program to enjoy trade-only events and discounts, COM and complimentary swatches, and services tailored to your specific needs, like extra customization options and extended returns. You can even use their design shops as an extension of your workspace. Become a trade member at serenaandlily.com/trade. And now, back to the show. So you were just starting to tell us, you, in the beginning, you left and you had the rug business and you said, but wait, I'm going to launch this whole new business and it's going to be sofas and fabric. And I mean, you've got boucle by the yard. There is quite a depth to what you're offering now. What was your vision for what you wanted Ben Soulmane to be? And tell people what the business is today.
So the business, what I wanted to be in, what it is, and it is more every day, is a go-to for top designers that are looking for good quality in stock. So one of the things that I learned and the world has gone towards is in stock is becoming more and more important. People don't want to wait. And part of the old model of waiting was sometimes they'd end up waiting too long, in the industry, right? Mm. And after waiting, they wouldn't get in the industry again of what, you know, was becoming an issue, is people would wait, not get what they ordered. They'd lose all that time. So this was out there in the market. This has been happening more and more in the last 10 years. So the opportunity of being in stock really works. Of course, you need more capital and you need to do things in a very different way because, you know, most of the design center businesses would get an order and then they'd go make it. That doesn't really work, I don't think, today. So I want it to be in stock and really serve the top designer that is dealing with the highest end of the market with what they need. What does a designer use every day? Amazing fabrics. I mean, I think that's the go-to every day. You use fabrics, high-end fabrics by the yard. So that's why we do fabrics by the yard, for example. And there's two purposes for it. Also, designers want to custom things a lot. They want to change dimensions on a sofa or a chair or a table. So we do a lot of custom. We have our own upholstery shop here in Southern California. So we can do any upholstery locally and custom it using any of our fabrics that you can buy by the yard. So the fabrics have two purposes. You could use any of them to, you know, customize, and you sell it by the yard, which we are actually doing quite well by selling it by the yard. Great fabric. I'm not doing real designs or anything too specific. I'm doing all the good textures that we all use, you know, linens, which I bought so much of myself in my lifetime at $200 a yard, $180 a yard, which we're selling, I think, for $50, $60 a yard. I mean, our pricing is, that's one thing too about the new company. The pricing is what it's supposed to be. The rugs are priced what they're supposed to be. The fabric is priced what it's supposed to be. We're not, I think most people, everybody that I talk to in the high end doesn't believe how good the quality is after they've seen the price first. They're very surprised of how good the quality is, but the price point is very reasonable.
Well, and how did you, knowing that you wanted to go after these designers that we've been talking about, how did you think about an e-commerce business, which is traditionally serving more of a consumer base versus a designer base? Or how did you think about it? How did you try to position it?
So I think, you know, you need to have a real trade program, a real trade program, church and state, no discounts unless, I mean, you know, the first year we were a little bit promotional. Sometimes we'd have sales and this and that. It was the first year of the business and it was mostly in rugs, but we are not a promotional company. We are not going to hold sales. If, of course, you know, you have a SKU that you want to discontinue, that might go on sale quietly, but we're not going to be holding these big sales. We are respecting the 20% for an in-stock company that you know, the difference of 20% makes more sense than if you order something and wait, you might want 25%, and companies can do that. But because our pricing is so competitive, the 20% is really the most we can do. But that's a great big number. I mean, at designer prices, our markups are not big. And I think it shows in the product and the pricing. So that 20% is a real big number for us. But we respect that to the designers. There's a whole process that you have to sign up and really show that you're a designer. And we check, we vet everything, make sure they're real designers. They get the 20%. They get many other perks with samples and this and that. So again, taking care of the designer. Everything is about taking care of the designer. We do the fabrics now. I'm selling my antique rugs again from my collection. I mean, that's for sale. So, I mean, we have, they come to us for antique rugs again. They come to us for fabrics by the yard. They come to us to customize a rug. They come to us. The timeline we give them the rug is half of anybody else. The price is normally much less. And they know they'll get it. So we're doing a lot. Our custom in rugs is huge business for us right now. And since we did the upholstery shop and we're doing custom work, we're doing the same with upholstery. We're doing the same with case goods. We're doing a lot of custom in that because designers want custom. Mm. Even though it's a website, you everybody can have it. The custom sort of separates it there as well. So we do a lot of custom work, and that trust is what brings us the custom work.
Tell me how you're thinking of that balance of what you know you need to have in stock and the things that you can sell immediately if you do versus the custom part of the business that more and more designers seem to want to make things more their own.
So if you look at our rugs, for example, or even our fabrics, where opportunities are for design. I go less after design and I go more after texture. The bread and butter everyday textures that we love, that we use. So that's what we do mostly with in stock, is the textures. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're not so iconic, less iconic as far as design, more iconic as far as texture, that I innovate with textures, with materials. I mean, that's what people have known me for. You know, for the last 20 some years, every press I get is about why am I different? Because of the textures that I've created. And again, goes back to the weaving and the know-how and all of that to create that. But so most of the rugs that we do are the fabrics that are in stock are these amazing textures that they love to use. So a lot of times they might custom a rug with their own design or something for one room and then build around it with these beautiful textures. So it's a combination. It works really well. So that's really how I envisioned it. And that's how really at the end of the day, it ends up working.
And as you think about it sort of long term, can you imagine that so much of this designer driven business will be done online? Is that, are you building out with that sort of infrastructure ready to go if it really does sort of move to a much more digital business, which it seems like it has in this past year, especially?
Absolutely. I mean, we do a lot of Zoom calls. We do a lot of seeing things without being there, even with designers in LA now. Instead of them coming to the showroom, that's what they do. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, the COVID era has changed things, and to some extent for the long term. So, you know, obviously, if they can, without spending an hour driving over there, parking, coming in and going back, if they could do it in 5 minutes on a Zoom call, they do. And it works. And, yeah. And you know, we have amazing samples. When it comes to rugs, everything has samples, fabric samples, wood samples, finished samples. We really invest a lot in samples. So that's another way of you can ship it and it's there the next day and they could see it in front of their eye. They could touch it. They could feel it. They could see the quality.
Does the holding inventory, not with the rug so much because you're used to that, but does holding inventory with sofas make you nervous at all? Do you, many businesses went away from inventory because they felt they could never really predict what people were going to want when, right? That was always the challenge. How are you thinking about it? And how are you getting around sort of being nervous about having a lot of sofa frames in stock that maybe people have moved on from or don't want at the time? How do you think about it?
You know, I mean, you have to be on top of your business week to week, see the trends. You know, I am so involved with that. I mean, I love design, I love creating, but I also know how to run a business. And you need to really be on top of the trends week to week, see how things are going. If you overstock in something, you need to have ways of fixing that. But you really have to plan ahead. You have to do a lot more planning than the old days. You know, with all the technology and everything is it supports you to do these things. So it's a lot better planning. Of course, furniture takes the downside on furniture is it takes a lot of room. So, you know, yes, you have to have the back end. Delivery is also a challenge with these bigger things and white glove and all of that, which we're perfecting and working on very diligently every day to get better and to perfect. So, you know, it has its own challenges, of course, but you adapt to it, you learn. And also coming from, you know, the experience of the last 10 years, I've learned a lot what issues are, what not to do, what to do when it comes to delivery and keeping inventory. And so I've been involved in the inventory keeping, obviously, for the last 10, going back to the last partnership. So, you know, it's planning the right way. Definitely needs a lot more planning, but it's not something that you cannot manage the right way.
When you think about your planning and you think about the world opening back up again, as we were just describing, do you think that the strength in home is likely to continue for years to come? And are you planning for that? Or are you sort of more taking a little bit of a, well, let's see how people feel when they come back out. Maybe they'll want to take a cruise. You and I don't want to take a cruise, I don't think, but others apparently want to take a cruise and do other things. What do you think? When the world reopens, are people going to continue to spend on their home in the way that they have?
I think the immediate reaction, of course, yes. A lot of people are going to get out and you know, God bless my parents. They got their vaccines, and you know, they go out, they go to lunch, they do things. So it's great to see that the people start to live again. And some of that is going to happen, which is good. But you know, things in life always sort of, if you look longer term, balance themselves out. So I think the immediate is, but maybe that's 1 year, but then things go back to normal. As far as the home goes, and the more, obviously, as we know, a lot of people, you know, are buying things for their home now. The home is sort of become your, it's funny, when we were doing marketing in the end of 2018, there's a tagline that we came up with, your home is your sanctuary, which today is so true.
Yes.
You know, it's sort of where you go to be safe. It's where you, where home is and where life is, you know, where kids are, where family is, where. So I think somewhat that is changed for good. I believe that a lot of people are going to continue working from home more so than before. So the home is that much more important. I do believe that also the trend in the last 5-10 years is to worry about the real things in life. And to sort of live more casually, perhaps a little bit, and use the spaces that you live in. So, you know, as we design things, they are practical and usable and beautiful. So, you know, that's what people want today. They want less maintenance. They want to be able to use things. That's what's so great about our performance rugs, for example, or performance fabrics. You know, they hold up to all of that staining and things like that. So I think people want to live more. You know, the idea of creating those big living rooms and never using them but once or twice a year when you had guests is not so much anymore, I believe. I believe people use their homes more today.
Yes.
And I think that will stay automatic for the first 6 months of maybe they spend them more on travel or clothes because they're now going out more. That might happen, of course. That does happen. But as a home business had a good uptick that will continue beyond next year, I do believe so. But we'll have to see. But I do believe that it was a better change. I mean, one positive thing, hard to say for COVID, was it did help the homeless.
Yes.
And people appreciating their home.
And the housing market. I mean, the housing market and sort of everything around that. And it brought the individual investor back to the stock market. I mean, it's really had so many sort of unexpected or unintended consequences during this
Absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely. And some of it will stay. And yes. I think some of it will stay.
Yes. Yes. Well, I'm excited to see what comes next. I'm excited to see the new website. It sounds like I won't have to wait long for that. I'm sure Marco's been working very hard on that. I look forward to seeing that. And I really appreciate you taking the time to spend with us, Ben. This has been great.
Thank you. You're great. Thank you so much. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to keep up with the latest industry news, browse job postings, or check out the latest product, visit us online at businessofhome.com. If you have a note for the podcast, drop us a line at podcast@businessofhome.com. This show was produced by Fred Nikolaus and edited by Albert Burge for Podfly. I'm Dennis Scully. Thanks again for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and I'll see you next week.